Hey, welcome back, everybody, to the Dose Adjustment Podcast. Special Forces Medic Mike Chesney.
I joined the service right out of high school, so 17 years old.
The SF Medic course was twice as hard as PA school.
What can I do in this space that'll help people in my space?
The information provided in this podcast is for educational and informational purposes only, and it does not establish a physician-patient or pharmacist-patient relationship. The opinions expressed by the hosts and guests are their own and do not constitute medical advice. This content is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any medical condition. Always consult with a licensed healthcare provider in your area before making any changes to your personal healthcare regimen or acting on any medical information shared in this podcast.
Hey, welcome back, everybody, to the Dose Adjustment Podcast. We have a really special episode today. We got special guest, Special Forces Medic Mike Chesney, and also my co-host, Christopher Hasenauer. So welcome back.
Right on. So what we're going to do today is kind of dive into some tactical medicine stuff, some stress management stuff, how it relates to men's health. And we're going to use some anecdotes in your story and my story, and we're going to talk through some things that we've experienced and just see where it takes us. So
it should be interesting.
It will be interesting. So we'll talk about that. So Mike is a former Special Forces medic, former Delta operator, and now retired. This dude living the dream, entrepreneur, really smart guy, good friend of mine. So the SF medic course, I've talked about it a little bit on podcasts and some other things, but it's an arduous, very intense thing. We develop the best medics in the world through the programs at Fort Sam, Fort Bragg, the different things that went down. And let's talk about your experience and doing that. I mean, how you started your military career, I guess.
Well, I always wanted to be a medic. Mm-hmm. My first plan was to be a doctor, of course, but the military, what they get, mm-hmm. they have the ability to let you become a medic and, the best that there are. Mm-hmm. I joined the service right out of high school. So 17 years old, mm-hmm. And wanted to be an enlisted guy. And, the recruiter, of course, first question he asked is, okay, what do you want to do? You can do anything in the military. I said, I want to be an airborne ranger. The guy mm-hmm. looked at me like I was nuts. He really did. He's like, why would you want to do that? I said, well, what else is there? Why would you want to do anything else in the Army? Why would you want to be anything but? At the time, what I thought was the best of the best, So that's what I did. Joined, went up to Fort Lewis, Washington. I was there for a couple of years. Went to jump school, ranger school, a lot of other mm-hmm. Army schools, and then realized that, hey, that wasn't the cream of the crop. What's next? And that's kind of been my career.
Life.
And life, I guess, forever. What's next? What's the next step? And so I went to the Special Forces Selection mm-hmm. course, which, as you well know, is no joke. It's pretty interesting. It's pretty intense. We started with probably 400 people plus, 90 people finished and only 60 of them were selected. Mm-hmm. So, pretty good washout rate of just the people. And that's just to get you the opportunity to go to school to learn. You don't get anything else out of it. You now have the ability to go to one of the hardest schools that there is in the military. So it's just a way to get in the door. And a lot of people don't realize that. And they think, I got the selection made. And those are the guys that don't make it through.
100%.
So, of course, I was a young E5 infantryman, mm-hmm. Airborne ranger, and I wanted to be a medic. Mm-hmm. If you wanted to call it for the Special Forces, I was a quintessential 18 Bravo or a weapons guy. I was the tactical expert. So that was what I got coming out of selection. The guy asked me, he said, hey, do you want to be an 18 Bravo or you want to stay in 11 Bravo? It's all up to you. Yeah. Those are your MOS codes, but one's an infantryman and the other one's a Special Forces weapons sergeant. Mm-hmm. So I said, well, I'll see you in a couple of months. Didn't ask any other questions. But I always wanted to be a medic. So after I was in for a couple of years, after I was in the 5th Special Forces Group for a couple of years, I put in, to get cross-trained, ended up being able to go down to Fort Sam, do the course, the academic F1. Course, which was called 300 F1 back then, mm-hmm. and then go to Fort Sam and finish up the, the med lab phase of it. Kind of a, just a off note that'll give you some perspective. When I went to the course, there were 30 other already Green Berets, Special Forces qualified guys that went with me to down to Fort Sam Houston. Of those 30, three of us graduated from the 18 Delta course. And these are already Green Berets. These are guys who are already in Special Forces. Only three of the 30 graduated from the 18 Delta course.
And what was taking these guys out of commission? Was it injury? Was it, were they being disqualified by the instructor cadre? Like, why don't you graduate? What's the limiting factor?
That is an academic course.
It's okay.
The it's part down there. It's all in your mind. I mean, it's all... And you're
physically not passing the test.
Yeah. So you're taking mentally. Yeah. Mentally. Like, so you're the SF medic course was twice as hard as PA school.
Okay.
Like just from just the drinking from the fire hose standpoint, it's like, okay, you're going to do anatomy one and two at the same time and you're going to be done with them in 5 weeks and you're going to do chemistry and it just doesn't stop because the military doesn't have time to let you take these hours slowly, whatever. Right. It's like, we need you now. And if you can't cut this, then you can't do it in combat.
Right.
And I think that's the key to it right there, Chris, is they put enough stress on you to where it's an indicator of how you're going to react when you are in combat. Because if you can't handle sitting in a classroom all day long or going on a paramedic ride on an ambulance or something like that, if you can't handle that for just, 9 months or 10 months, however long it is, how well are you going to handle when your guys get blown up the first time and you're the only person that can help them?
Yeah.
So that's a good part of it. That's why they put all this stress on you.
It is. And that's one thing that the military does great. And even in the selection process, I mean, they're looking for individuals that have a very unique stress response profile. They're looking for almost like sociopathic tendencies without being diagnosable. Like you're like, okay, like it's a super interesting thing because you're not leaving the country to go do very nice things.
Right.
You know, you're going to do really bad shit because your government needs you to go do really bad shit. So you dive into that. You finish the 18 Delta course. You've already got some SF time. You were on triple nickel at this point.
So I was, it was a pretty amazing thing. When I was 18 Bravo, I was on a special SOT team or a CQB close quarters battle team. Mm-hmm. And that's what we did for the first couple of years I was in. But when I came back as a medic and a weapons guy, you're in pretty high demand at that point. And so I got picked to go to triple nickel, which is kind of the most famous or notorious A team in 5th Special Forces Group. So I was on triple nickel for a couple of years. Then I was asked to become the medic on the free fall team. So I went to the free fall team. I was on that free fall team for a couple of years. Did 4 years on a special projects team and then went and was selected to go to Delta.
How old were you when you did Delta selection?
33.
Right. So when you look at these other, all of these special operations units, as they kind of grow and they're looking for a certain level of maturity and to a point where you haven't really destroyed your body yet. Mm-hmm. It's a super interesting thing. So Mike and I have known each other for a few years. Years ago, I tried out to go to be a Delta medic and didn't make it. And I think it's the first time I met you and I met a bunch of other guys at the time. And it was like, come back later, is essentially what I got. And then we ended up working together up in DC years later, teaching some classes together for all kinds of just different people. But it's been this really interesting mentor relationship. And I won't tell you how much I appreciate it because I saw things and learned things from you guys that I hadn't quite reached that point in my own life, but as I have, I've always got the ability to reach back and like, hey, this is going on. I really need to talk to somebody about this. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of, so you tried out. So you're 33, you go to Delta selection. How did your stress responses from the things that you had done change from going? Cause now you are going to what the US government, pretty much the world considers the best of the best. How did that change in your ability to manage obviously these hyper stressful situations that you're going to put yourself into?
Well, I think for me, I was a lot more mature. So that helped me. A lot of people ask me, well, why'd you wait so long? You know, mm-hmm. Well, 5th Special Forces Group was pretty hot back in the 90s. And mm-hmm. So it was kind of the place to be. If there was anything going on in the world, you were the ones that got to go do it because the Middle East is their area of responsibility. Mm-hmm. And so that's where all the bad stuff was going on. So that's where they kept sending us. So it was fun.
Yeah.
Why stop doing something that's fun? And I really, truly enjoyed it. Enjoyed being there, enjoyed my job there. But kind of the catalyst was I peaked. You know, I'd gone as pretty much as far as I could go in mm-hmm. in Special Forces at the time, in on what we call the white side of Special Forces. Mm-hmm. I'd kind of done everything that I could do there already. Mm-hmm. So it was kind of a natural progression for me. Mm-hmm. That's the way I always saw it. I saw, hey, what's next?
What's next?
What's the next big thing that we can do? So the stress part for me was all personal. It was a personal stress thing because I wanted to be, you know, the fastest, the best, just like everybody else. Everybody there is the epitome, I guess, of a type A personality.
Yeah.
It's the craziest thing because you get to this place where everybody has massive egos, but they're all in check. And it's the most interesting thing in the world because like we're like all a bunch of assholes, but when we're together, we're like, we're good.
Yep.
It's crazy. And so when you look at these things, do you think it was compartmentalization? And I'm kind of, okay, so absolutely. So I'm kind of, it's a leading question.
I got you. And now I'm picking up what you're putting down. So that's, I guess that's kind of has been my response my entire life to stress mm-hmm. is suck in, compartmentalize it, move on past it. Mm-hmm. Because anything that happened yesterday, there's nothing you can do about it. You can't change it. There's nothing you can do about it. And the more you ask why or how or whatever, the deeper you go into that hole, that big spiral that you keep going down. But if you just, and that was me, mm-hmm. like most guys, I guess, if you compartmentalize that stuff and just, hey, cram it back in that little black box that's way back there in the back. How big is it? Mm-hmm. I mean, that thing's big. You can put a lot of stuff in it.
Yeah.
You know, because, you know, by that time already in the Army, I had seen a lot of things, you know, mm-hmm. a lot of good and bad things that
right.
had gone down. So there's a lot of stuff already crammed in that box. Then getting to go to a place where people that are mediocre mm-hmm. there are literally rock stars anywhere else that they go.
Yep.
Anywhere. If you are mediocre there, you will be the top guy wherever else you go. Guy, gal, whatever it is, you'll yep. be the top that there is. So one, I mean, it's always great knowing that no matter what, your guys are going to take care of you. That's of all the places I've ever worked in my life, that's the one where I never was worried mm-hmm. that I wasn't the guy to my left and right wasn't mm-hmm. going to take care of me. Never a doubt. Mm-hmm. You never even doubt it. And mainly it's a program thing. I mean, it's a training thing. You do it every day. You train with one another every single day. You do the same things over and over until you get them not right, until you get them perfect. That's the key. People say all the time, you know, practice makes perfect. Well, that's a lie. It is a lie. Perfect practice makes perfect. If you practice doing it wrong over and over again, then guess what? When you're really stressed out, you're going to do it wrong. That's how it's going to happen. So perfect practice makes perfect, not practice makes perfect. So you do it the right way every time. And like you said earlier, you got to drop the ego at the door mm-hmm. because everybody that's there is as good or better than you.
Yeah.
Everyone. And you have to be able to take extremely constructive or even destructive criticism and suck it up and move on because you don't have time to not learn from every mistake that you or anybody else makes. And then you have to move past it because you can't then make that same mistake again. Well, one, because you won't have a job, and two, because that could cost somebody their life.
Yes, absolutely. So you look at these things and you're this, it's this hyper-focused, very real, very specific mission target set, these things. And you are, again, training. So it is in the military world, it's the Super Bowl.
Oh, yeah,
it's absolutely what it is. You are at the Super Bowl every day. So you've done this, you've gone on, and you retired out of this. That's where you finished your career, right?
Yeah, I was medically retired out of there in 2010.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. So there's some, we'll get into some stories on that, but in that time, we're looking at your stress response, we're looking at the things that you developed, the skills you developed. You left in 2010 medically, so there's probably some stuff to unpack there. And then did those skill sets serve you when you were out?
100%. I mean, one thing, I think the easiest thing or the easiest way to answer that is self-confidence. Mm-hmm. It's probably the biggest thing that a person, any human being can have. So confidence in yourself and what you can do. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, when you sit back and think about it, when I left the military, I was the guy that everybody else in the Army wanted to be. Yeah. Every other, you know, hard charging mm-hmm. person in the Army wanted to be me. And then the next day it was gone.
Yep.
Literally, it was gone. Yeah. I mean, I was hurt. I was training to get back in and go back and become operational again. It just never happened.
Yep.
So then, you know, like everything, I was a tool, and that tool was now not as sharp as it used to be, and yep. it was broken. So they put that tool aside and got a new one. And of course, no matter how good you think you are,
your ego,
you're going to be replaced, whether they're as good at it as you or not. Mm-hmm. You're going to get replaced. I mean, you are literally a tool.
Mm-hmm. So left that, you left the military. Did you dive right into being an entrepreneur? You know, let you talk about some of the other things and back into college and these different things mm-hmm. that you've done. And then continue with that. Like, okay, so the stress responses, the compartmentalization, the different stuff. How did that come back and change later? Like when did the compartment empty? Because I mean, you've heard my story. My story on here. I mean, it does empty.
It does. And it's not a good time when it does that. It is not a good way. Like most people who have been through, and I'll have to call it a life altering mm-hmm. event mm-hmm. that changed who I was and what I was doing. First I went through almost like the five stages of grief. You know, I was angry. I was trying to blame it on other people. Then I got depressed, and then, you know, it wasn't all at once. You know, when I got to that final acceptance stage way later on, that you are never going to be who you were before. You've got to get that out of your head.
And how soon after leaving the military was this happening? Was this like immediate, you know, day one, who am I, what happened?
Almost. It was almost like that, because I was, you know, 25 years of my life. Every morning when I woke up, I knew where I was going, mm-hmm. what I was doing. I even knew what I was wearing. You know, it seems silly, but my life had been regimented for 25 years. I mean, I got up in the morning, I went to work, I worked out, I had breakfast, and then I trained. And I mean, that was it. It was a regimented way of life. And then, you know, the day after I signed my retirement papers, I was literally sitting on my couch at home thinking, what in the hell am I going to do now? You know, what am I going to do? Mm-hmm. And for a while, I was kind of lost. You know, I tried to dive back into some work. I did some healthcare consulting, you know, in all the places where you want to go and vacation at, you know, Afghanistan, Iraq, North Africa. Those are the places I went in to do some work, you know. But
it's not where I thought you were going with that.
healthcare consulting. I like that.
Healthcare consulting. So, and I got disgruntled with it, you know, because a lot of the things that we were doing, I mean, you just see everything's crooked. You know, everybody's trying to get what they can for themselves. And it was counter to who I was and what I was doing. You know, I was in the military where I had to rely on Chris to my right and Amir to my left. I had to rely on them every day. I realized outside,
it's not like that.
It's on you.
Yeah.
It is completely on you. And I mean, when you're in Kabul, Afghanistan, all by yourself, and the next thing you know, it's like, what happens?
Yeah.
The big green machine is not going to come get me. I'm a civilian. I'm here working as a contractor. Yep. What's going to happen if I'm in the wrong place at the wrong time? Oh, no. All right. I'm done. I'm out of this. So got away from that.
So you're contracting. Are you contracting for the U.S. government, or are you contracting for other organizations that are contracted by the U.S. government?
Both. Mainly for for other. We had our own company that was doing it, and we were contracted by the government to go and help the ministries of health in the different places.
But there was no QRF coming to?
There is nothing.
Okay. Well, not shit coming.
You got nothing. I mean, you're there to do your healthcare stuff, and that's it.
Okay.
So I stopped doing that, but I still didn't have I didn't have another mission. You know, I didn't know what was next. I didn't have a purpose. I'd lost my purpose. And I lost my community. I mean, think about this. Think about, like you said earlier, you're an NFL football player and you've been playing with this same team for 10 years. Mm-hmm. And the next thing you know, you're hurt and your team's off playing the same games, doing the same stuff. And you're not. I mean, you're sitting on the side. You're not even sitting on the sidelines. You're sitting home watching on television. Out completely. Takes away who you were.
It is. It's a kick in the teeth because you're sitting there. Like, I've had where you're talking to people and, like, you know, unit I was in and I left and then they're gone and they're like, okay, well, we got a thing to do. I'm like, I want to know what the thing is. You know, it's not that you really matter, but you're like, what are we doing?
Well, what are you doing?
I don't get, and you don't and get you to go. Can't. And you can't ask. You can't know. You're not read in on the project. You're like, man, this sucks. You know, and it is. It's really hard. I struggled with that. I mean, we've obviously talked about that in depth, but so when you've left these projects, you're doing this and then decided, obviously that was like your toe into being an entrepreneur and the different stuff. So where did that go from there?
Well, I have to back up a half a step because part of me realizing I needed to do something else with my life besides that was I was injured. I was still hurt. Mm-hmm. I was trying to fight through whatever pain and whatever else was going on.
And just for clarity, what was the injury? Was it legs or knees?
My shoulder, neck, back.
Little everything.
Leg, you know. So I'd broken pretty much everything up.
Physical limitations.
Okay. Yep. And then again, of course, with everything else, you start to build that baggage up. All of us have, you know, all of us who have been in combat have the one thing that bothers us more than anything else, and it's survivor's guilt.
Yep.
100%, anybody that I know that has been there and done it, that's the thing that bothers you more than anything else, is why me? How did I get to come home and nobody else did? And those guys didn't. Mm-hmm. That's the biggest thing that bothers you. Well, when you don't have anything, nothing to do, no mission, no...
Start thinking about it a whole bunch.
It starts rolling around in your head. Well, what if I... Could I have done this better? Would I have, you know, I literally, and this is probably the first time I've ever said this, I dreamed about being back at work for 2 years afterwards. I mean, I would dream at night and I was back with my team doing things every night for 2 years. I mean, every single night. And I was like, man, something is wrong with this.
Yeah.
I'm needing something. And I didn't know what it was. And I got invited to go on a trip with some other disabled and wounded vets. And they told me I was going fly fishing. I fly fished once or twice with a good friend of mine named Chris Murphy, but that was it. Mm-hmm. You know, everything else I'd never done. And so I said, cool, I'll get to do this. Oh, and you get to bring your wife. That was what sold me, you know. I'm like, hey, I'll get to bring my wife along, maybe to help out a little bit. And what I realized when I got there is it was everybody from every walk of the military. I mean, I had guys that were privates in the Marine Corps and, you know, colonels in the Air Force that were all in the same group. Mm-hmm. And all of us had the same issues. And I didn't, you know, I'm back then, especially, I didn't talk about anything like that. I'm big, bad, barrel chested freedom fighter. There's nothing wrong with me. Until I got there and realized, hey, every one of these people suffers the same way. They all have the same survivor's guilt. They all have these same things going on. And I just said, hey, you know, instead of just sitting back and suffering with this, maybe I can help somebody get through it. And that was the step that started me getting better. I think that's the one thing that started me to do better.
Yeah, I kind of same thing. I mean, I remember even in PA school, on my psych rotation going in to do a, I mean, this is a, in the military, you know, OCS Canada, PA student going in to help with a PTSD group. And like, this is fucking bullshit. And walking out, I was like, this is not a real thing. Nope. Like, it's like, this is all made up. Like my barrel chested freedom fighter ego is like, nope, this is a thing. And man, it's the thing.
It's real.
It's absolutely real. And that
it is real.
And it, and you get there and it is life changing. And it, what we find, and this is kind of what I was leading into, is like, you have all these stress management compartmentalization techniques. The military has selected you, found you, molded you, trained you to be able to do these things. Then you leave. You don't have those support systems. You don't have your tribe. You don't have these things. And then you're not that busy. Like, you realize that the busy, the op tempo was your therapy.
Mm-hmm.
Like, that was keeping you sane. And we watch it in our patients. We see it all the time. Like, it's transferable. You got CEOs that work themselves. I mean, hell, I still do it when I'm going bad. I'm like, oh, let's keep working. Let's go find another project. So we look at these things and we break that down. And then, just like you said, you have to find that purpose. And we develop projects. We do these other things and we're working on some projects together. We'll touch on those in a minute. But so we know that there's a problem. Had this very storied career. You're in this place in life. And then now we're like, okay, we've developed this problem. And back to these stress management techniques that you had been trained to learn, then they're not working anymore.
Right.
So what did we, where'd you go from there?
Well, part of what happened to me is I got a pretty significant brain injury. So the military had sent me, while I was still on active duty, the last year I was in, to a brain injury rehab center in a civilian one in Houston at the Tier Memorial Hermann facility, same one that, Senator Gifford went to when she got shot.
Yep.
Exact same thing. And I thought, okay, what do these civilians know about what I've been through? What are they going to do to help me get better? And there were three or four of us that had gone in together into this group. And the first few days maybe even the first few weeks, I was really, I'm not too sure about how this is going to work. And then it kind of clicked in my head what they were trying to do.
Mm-hmm.
They knew we were all going to have to transition and we were all not going to be military guys in a very short period of time.
Yeah.
So it was not only a treatment for the brain injury itself and helping to rewire those neural pathways. It was about helping you transition because now I'm having to sit in a room full of people every day. I mean, I had a guy and there was a bull rider, had a lady that was one of the top executives at Shell who had gotten into a car accident. Now their lives are completely changed, drastically changed. But they had a lot of therapies that they talked about and did there that kind of got in my head. And the biggest one was food is medicine. You know, and pharmacists might not like to hear this, but
don't worry about that.
A lot of the things that are wrong with us, you can mitigate. I mean, you can't fix them all, but you can mitigate a lot of them by what you eat, how you eat, what your nutritional status is. And I also learned that obviously the food pyramid is upside down and there's a lot of other things, and that's for a whole nother podcast.
Yeah, absolutely.
I realized that nutrition was a big part of it. So, you know, what starts happening here? Okay, well, what can I do in this space that'll help people in my space? Back military guys, operational people, you know, the soldiers, sailors, airmen, marines, coasties that are out there. What can I do that'll help them? And so I started trying to look around, try to find something that intrigued me. And the first thing I started working on was this like a protein, high energy protein shake for the military. And while I was doing it, I came across some research that DARPA had done back in the beginning of the second Gulf War, I guess you call it, back in 2003. And it was on a nutritional supplement that would increase your physical performance and your cognitive ability. And so I found it, found out the program had ended. So I cold called the lady who ran the program and said, hey, what are you doing with this? She said, well, it's funny you should ask. We're not doing anything with it. And so I flew over to London, went to Oxford and met with the lady who had come up with this. And it kind of triggered something in my head. I was like, man, if we can take this and get it to every soldier, sailor, airman, marine that's out there who gets a head injury, I can help them. Yeah. So the that's what triggered what I'm doing now. So then I had to go back to school and learn how, pretty much how to be a biochemist. Mm-hmm. Everything that goes with the nutritional side mm-hmm. that I was working on. So, and that's led me to where I am now, which is, you know, I help run a nutritional supplement company that provides these things out to everybody, not just soldiers
And you're finishing your doctorate. Have finished.
I'm finishing my doctorate of science in December, mm-hmm. and so that I'm very, very happy and proud about that. But
yeah, that's awesome.
And it's all about this. This is what drove me to get there.
Yeah, this has been the mission set, and it's. I find it because like we go on these as we've been developing this show out, everything kind of goes back into like human performance, and that's exactly what you're talking about. You've taken something where you. Or at the top of human performance, you're what person that can attest to the needs of that space. And now you're developing the nutritional supplements and the things that optimize that, which is phenomenal. So we'll let you plug all that stuff here at the end and talk about the garage.
I just wanted to cover what.
We definitely want you to plug it because I want people to know where it is and where to get it. My next question is the stress management techniques. If you have a stress management technique that you took from SF, that you took from Delta, you took from the military, that you still use, like as far as like, okay, I'm in a spot, shit has gone sideways, how am I going to calm the fuck down right now? What would that be?
One is common sense.
Yeah.
You use common sense for everything you're doing. And two is breathing, of all things, breath control. And not stopping and doing this whole, you mm-hmm. know, mantra, which I'm 100% a fan of, but you can't do that whenever things are happening in the moment. So it's that stop, even if it's for 3 seconds, mm-hmm. stop, think about what you're going to do, take a deep breath and do it. Mm-hmm. And this is physiological as well. You're taking a deep breath. You're stimulating your vagus nerve. It's doing the opposite. Mm-hmm. of what it normally does, which is downregulate everything, and it upregulates it. Yeah. So you're turning on your sympathetic nervous system
to do the
fight or flight, as opposed to your parasympathetic, which is, you know, feed or breed.
Yep.
So I'm turning that feed or breed off completely.
Because I have to act.
Because I have to act and stepping into, it, basically forcing yourself into using your sympathetic nervous system and overloading your adrenal glands.
Yep.
So, you know, early on, I would read a lot of leadership books and a lot of guys from the military as well. And so the technique that I kind of took away from a multitude of individuals was, I think it was very similar. It's like, take a breath, look around and make a call. Mm-hmm. And I use that tremendously in the pharmacy because like, obviously never been in a combat situation, but like, I feel like bombs are dropping, you know, the phone's going off. This lady is yelling down here, like literally screaming. I've got a doctor walking in that I want to build a relationship with. I've got my best customer over there who is waiting and waiting and waiting. I've got a technician who just, you know, ran out the door to go to the bathroom. Another one called out. It is not going right, you know, and especially in more high volume pharmacies where we're doing 600-700 scripts in a day. And I use that technique to say, hey, okay, I need you to get the voicemail. Zach, I need you to go down there and calm that lady down. Mm-hmm. Go home. I'll take care of this, you know? And so it is a really good technique, but most people, they just get completely paralyzed and unable to make a decision, unable to direct other people. Right. Yeah, and before you know it, you know, they're the ones who are hiding under the bench crying. And I've literally seen pharmacists hiding from customers under the bench, you know, crying or telling me to get down. Like, yeah. We're going to crawl out of here. Like, it's some sort of combat. I'm like, it's fine. Just
talk to them.
Yeah. So, great technique. I love you sharing that.
So, all right. So, we talked about the stress, this kind of stress management. I'm going to shift gears a little bit because over the course of your career, you saw a lot of things change and develop in tactical medicine. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that we do, Amir and I both, we work with Guerrilla Medical and we develop tactical training and we teach basically civilians emergency preparedness. Of all the things that you saw and the changes over time from like, you know, put it in a context from using the ABCs and basic first aid to the March algorithm or whatever, what do you think the biggest change, most life-saving thing that you saw in TACMED was over the course of your career?
Gat tourniquet. 100%. If you look back, and this is how this was developed. If you look back at what were the life ending, not life altering, what were the life ending injuries in Vietnam? They were all extremity hemorrhage. Exsanguination through you're bleeding out from a limb. Well, I mean, it's perfect common sense that, well, if it's bleeding out, just stop it. I mean, put, you know, take your belt off, make a tourniquet. Well, the tourniquets that we had were not that. They were not good. I mean, basically, if you put it on somebody, they were going to lose that limb because they weren't designed correctly. So the biggest, the one thing that's changed the most in tactical medicine, in my opinion, and I'll tell you, if people know what they're talking about, that they're going to tell you the same thing, is a readily available tourniquet that not only is, that works, but one that everybody can use. You need to have something that anybody can use it. It's got to be simple, easy to use, and readily available. And that's what we've done. That's kind of the change in tactical medicine. And it's not just in the military. It's really turned into all of the...
It's all walks of life.
All walks of life when it comes to emergency medicine.
I think it has. I mean, the civilian adoption has been interesting because in the latter part of my career, starting to see civilians adopt the idea of tourniquets. And Amir is a very avid outdoorsman in that sense. I've been even talking, and I mean, you teach your kids how to use them. I teach my kids how to use them, the stop the bleed courses. We teach these things. So I 100%, I think that that's awesome. And I mean, that's a cool thing because I mean, you, I know you witnessed the development of that project and all the things that went with it. And it's just, you know, without getting into too much, you want to kind of tell the story of how that project was developed.
Well, that tourniquet came out of, out of the unit, out of the combat applications group at Fort Bragg. But it wasn't an R&D project. It was an individual group of medics that got together and made this. So the military didn't give, you know, it wasn't a, you know, thing about, hey, here's a bunch of money, go out and find this thing. It was two or three medics that got together and said, hey, let's build a better mousetrap. And they did. And then it's progressed from there. I mean, obviously whenever there's big things like this and there's a lot of money involved, there's a lot of politics that happen. There's a lot of bad things that happen with that, which the biggest one is none of those people, none of the guys who actually invented it or did anything with it really got anything substantial out of it. Well, one guy did, but I'll leave that alone.
Who owns the intellectual property or the patents, I guess?
Right now it's North American Rescue owns them.
They were able to purchase that?
They were able to purchase it, yes.
Interesting.
From the wrong person. Sorry.
No,
you're
good. All right. So we talked that. We talked physiological. We talked breathing. We've gone down the things. So current projects. Let's kick around some of the current projects you've got going on.
So currently, most of what I work on is based on helping veterans. I mean, that's what my life revolves around. So I work with two different 501c3 nonprofits mainly. I work with several of them, but the two that I work with mainly are one from Florida called Combat Veterans to Careers. It's a great program that David Booth, a retired master sergeant up in Leesburg, Wildwood area, came up with. He's had it for many years, and he's got well over 3,000 alumni that he's taken care of there. An amazing program. And he now has the What's Next program, something that, you know, he developed a moniker for it, but it makes perfect sense. What are we going to do next? What's the next thing that we can do to help vets, whether it's recreational therapy, whether it's something else? And the latest thing that we're working on is partnering with Chris and with Amir and getting ketamine treatment for our veterans out there and first responders and everybody that needs it, getting that ketamine treatment, not having to come to one place to get it, but making that a mobile thing where we can go out and bring that therapy to the community. And I'll tell you right now, from a personal experience, it's completely changed my life. And you don't have to ask me. You talk to my wife. I mean, she tells everybody. I don't know who he was before, but I hope this guy don't leave. That's the comment that my wife has for other people. She tells me all the time, well, I'm not going to get used to this, but, you know, hey, I feel like you're doing pretty good. And if your wife can tell you that after 38 years of being married, yeah, something has changed for you. And it's 100% this ketamine therapy. And I mean, it's not like you're doing it. It is a very good, solid therapy for anybody who's suffering from the symptoms of a traumatic brain injury, from post-traumatic stress, I mean, it's an amazing thing.
Yeah.
One, thank you for bringing that into my life. But yeah.
And Chris, I know we're going to do a whole show segment on this, but can you maybe give us a 2-minute overview of, you know, what role ketamine therapy plays in PTSD and other things?
So in the context of behavioral health, particularly in this case, PTSD, TBI, neuroplasticity is king. And essentially ketamine is low dose ketamine, not surgical dose ketamine. It causes a hyper neuroplastic state, which allows your brain to develop or heal neuropathways and gives you a transient antidepressant effect and the ability to make talk therapy and these other therapies, whether, you know, we've talked on massage, we've talked about hyperbaric oxygen, we've talked about a lot of different things, but it makes these other therapies work better. So it's kind of the way I explain it to all my military guys is like, if you're going to therapy and the goal is to have a breakthrough, you know, talk therapy is like a little Shawshank Redemption hammer and ketamine is a block of C4. You're going to have a breakthrough. It's going to happen.
So typically it's always in combo?
Everything's in combo. Like any tool by itself, right? You can't build a house with one hammer, right? Like you've got to use all the tools. Ketamine is just that big sledgehammer that knocks all the shit out of the way so we can actually get to work.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I like that. I think that's a good way to look at it. Ketamine is the demo that you do before you remodel.
Yep.
Then you use all the other tools.
Yep.
Using all the tools. Construction.
Yeah, and you're writing another project. Yep. Okay, so we've kind of gone down that. Books, media, you've talked. So your mission now is obviously this improvement, helping vets, helping. I mean, I've come to some of your other events, been on the fishing tournaments. I mean, you're absolutely doing it. It's all the work is impressive, and it's good to see because I remember you from various stages in my career and different walks of life. And I mean, you do have purpose. I mean, it's a very different thing, and you're way less angry.
Yeah, I'm way less angry.
You're way less pissed off. So if you had advice for a veteran leaving the military, like one piece of advice for them right now, what would that be?
Don't do any of this by yourself. Find a group, one friend, whatever it is. Don't try to navigate this by yourself because I'll tell you, it's impossible. It's completely impossible. You were part of a tribe your entire military career. Mm-hmm. Find a new tribe. That's what that's my one thing. Find that new tribe, whether it's a veterans group, whether it's just a group of friends that goes, you know, fishing together or hunting together or hiking together, whatever it is. Find somebody else that's going to help you do it. And there's nobody better than other veterans who also know exactly what you're going through, how you feel, what it is. I mean, like Chris talked about, one of the groups that I work with is called Wounded War Heroes, and it's a great organization. They do recreational therapy for vets, and they do a great job of trying to prevent suicide out there. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we tell them, hey, you want to go on this great hunting trip? And they're like, yeah, sure, I'd love to go on a hunting trip. And the hunting trip has nothing to do with why they're really going. They're going to spend time with like-minded veterans, just like themselves.
Yep.
And other people who are so appreciative of what you've done that they're giving their
time,
benefits and their time. You know, they're giving you their special ranch in Texas that they've worked their whole life to build and have, and they're taking you there and making you part of it. So make sure you get a tribe. Get that new tribe, and that tribe need it. For me, that tribe was other veterans. Mm-hmm. That's what kept me going. I mean, there's plenty of people out there. One other thing for veterans that are getting ready to retire, the military is going to go away. Your family will not. Work on your family relationship. Work on your personal relationship with your significant other, with your friends. Work on those personal relationships, because the more that they support you, the longer or the easier your transition is going to be. If you isolate, that transition is going to last maybe forever. You may never transition out of being in the military mindset and not being able to be a functioning member of a normal society.
Is there a national online resource that people would go to or check out that would be just like something that's on a weekly basis? Like there's a broadcast going on and it's all veterans all the time talking about different topics and connecting people. Like, is there that group out there?
Not really. So the one thing that we've been kicking this around, and one of the things we want is is looking for like a clearinghouse for these kind of things, kind of saying like a deconfliction of all these different things. And kind of goes back to what he's saying though, like the tribe is like, what are you finding? I mean, there's veterans, motorcycle clubs, all these different things. At the end of the day, it just comes down to being able to find a group of people you could talk to, people you can connect with. It's human connection. And veterans struggle with that because their version of connection is so regimented for so long in their career. And a lot of the things they do, specifically in the special operations community, a lot of things they do, they can't talk about with anybody else.
Yeah.
Like you can't, there's stories that you just can't share. You know, you're just like, oh, and you just kind of look at each other and shrug and you're like, okay, let's go. And so I think that is a phenomenal point, a next step, a just how it develops out. I don't know. I think that's one of the things that we're trying to do with these different projects. But
yeah, even if it was a bridge, you know, just for people getting out, hey, at least I can tune in every, almost like a church service, right? Yeah. Every Sunday morning, I know I can log in and there's something going on, you know, that I'm interested and want to see and get connected. And yes, I think you need that person to person. But if that central resource could start somehow potting those out, you know what I mean? That would be really cool.
There's a couple of, they've tried a couple of times to make what you're talking about, this all-encompassing nonprofit for veterans. There was one that's got started back probably 10 years ago, which was mandated of all things from the Joint Chiefs of Staff. And then once it was built, they didn't support it. So it's, you know, normal, stuff. So they mandated that all of these veteran nonprofits that had best practices all joined together. Got together. So they started this thing. It was called the R4 Alliance. And it was very successful for a short period of time, but then nobody was using it the way that it was designed to, and you got no support from the people who told you to design it. So that program morphed into another group called the America's Warrior Partnership that's out there. Good group, and they're more of a holistic group, but that's one where people could go to. And there's a lot of resources there. Wounded Warrior Project, it's had its
ups and downs.
I think they're on the upside now. They fund other groups, which is what they do best, I think. So, and they're another good resource if people want to reach out and find something.
Right on. So I got a few kind of rapid fiery questions for you here at the end, and then we'll have you plug some. I would like you to talk about some of the other business ventures. But today, like right now, at this point in your life, what keeps you grounded?
My family, 100%. Yeah. My family keeps me grounded.
And Disney World. I know you guys do a lot of Disney with all those grandkids.
I have a couple of grandkids that are down here, and they like to go. So I mean, family is what keeps me grounded every day.
Right on. What is one thing that you would tell 17-year-old Mike as he's starting his military career?
You don't have to be the best at everything. I wish I would have listened to that. But it drove me to where I am now. But, man, it hurt along the way.
Yeah.
And that's the biggest thing, man. I beat myself up. Mm-hmm. I beat this poor body up for 25 years. I mean, till the end, I tried everything I could to keep doing what I was doing. And I would tell him, hey, you know, don't take yourself quite so seriously.
Yeah. And all right, know you pretty well. You're always prepared. So, what is one piece of gear, everyday carry stuff that you? We'll take guns off the table because I know you got guns. But what's one piece of gear, everyday carry stuff that you always have with you?
Like most people, pocket knife. But the biggest as far as main like medical gear, I always have a tourniquet in every vehicle that I have.
Mm-hmm.
If I was smart enough, I'd carry it on me, but it's kind of hard in your shorts and stuff. But I have a tourniquet in my side-by-side, in my truck, in my wife's car, everything. And everybody that rides in it, that like my wife knows how to use them. My kids know how to use them.
Yeah.
So, I mean, that's something you could save somebody's life. Somebody gets in a motorcycle accident, you pull over, put that on them, you just saved their life. Get in your car and leave. Let the cops deal with it. But, yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, don't hang around.
Don't stay around.
Yeah. All right. So let's dive in. I want you to talk about, you've talked about all nonprofits, talk to me about some of the business stuff you're doing, and then social media handles, websites, anything you want anybody to look at.
Yeah. The biggest thing that I'm working on now is the nutritional supplement side. Two companies. One is a research company. So it does all of the research on everything, and the other is the nutritional supplement company. One's called Tecton Ketones. That's just like tectonic plates. And the other one is just called Tecton Research. Pretty simple. And the websites are just what I just said, tectonketones.com, tectonresearch.com. So very easy to get to. And what we do is kind of holistic. It works on a lot of different things. So check it out. It's pretty good.
No, it's good stuff. I absolutely encourage you to get on there and order some Tecton. The drinks are good. Got some other options if you want to mix them with some Halo. they work pretty well. But
I was going to say, I think we can do a whole episode on it because I'm still fascinated by it. I'm sure you've got some protocols to go with it. I'd really like to have you back to really discuss through those and how it could impact different disease states that are impacting a majority of men. 50 or 60% of men, I think, could be really valuable. So, and I had one more, just kind of a personal question. Mm-hmm. So I've got a young son who is, you know, dead set on the military, and he's dead set on being a Marine, right? And so as a father, I'm looking at the advertisement portion of the military, right? Right? Because they're advertising to these kids. Now, I'm assuming that every branch, you know, they want to pull people into their branch, right? Mm-hmm. And so we're rolling through Chattanooga, and I think there was an Air Force sign, and it had two sweet F-35s doing a bank through the mountains. And I'm like, that seems pretty cool. And it was like, come join us. Like, you're going to be the one that gets to fly the jet, know. But I guess, how much competition is there amongst the different military divisions to pull people in? How much of it's just advertising? And if you were a father who was guiding a son to pick which lane he was going to go in, because he's going and he wants to jump out of airplanes, right? You know, what would you look at? How would you guide them without a bias? Because you
got I have to put this bias in there because it's not a good one. It's a negative bias, I guess. If you look at it in one way, every young person that comes to me and says, "Hey, I want to join the military," first thing I do is ask them, "Well, why?" Mm-hmm. You know, what's the purpose of joining? And most of them are just, "Hey, I need a change in my life. I need something different." That was me. I mean, I needed direction. I was like, what am I going to do? But that was the difference. But I tell all of them, when it comes to the services, having spent 25 years on active duty, I have seen which services take better care of their members. Mm-hmm. So that's how I rank what I tell young people to do. A man that wants to do something really sporty, join the Air Force and become a pararescue or a combat controller.
All day.
That's what you want to do. If you want to be, you know, all that there is and have somebody take care of you, join the Air Force and go into the Air Force Special Operation. Second, I hate to say it, but the Navy. The Navy takes good care of their people. Then the Army. And unfortunately, lastly, the Marine Corps, only because of the way I saw the Marine Corps are the bastard children of the military, and it's not their problem. It's not their fault. Marines are amazing. I love Marines. I've fought side by side with them for years. I really have lots of respect for Marines. The problem is the institutionalization of the Marine Corps is different. Their command rides over them, and if the chain of command breaks down, unless you have one or two really stellar people that are going to jump up and take that place, because of the way that they're trained, usually everything falls apart.
Yeah.
So that's why I would say, tell them to join the Air Force, then the Navy, then join the Army in that progression, only because that's how they take care of each other. As an Army guy, it's hard to say, but it really is. I mean, and I've worked with the...
Mine is much simpler than that. My explanation for being a combat controller, one, it's a badass job. You literally get to jump out of airplanes and drop bombs on people, which is super cool. And when I was in Afghanistan, our CCT was there. He was in our team house. I went in his room and like sat on his bed because we were talking. And the Air Force had sent that motherfucker a Tempur-Pedic mattress to the middle of Afghanistan. I was like, I am in the wrong place. So that is my...
You know, it's very interesting because, you know, at the pharmacy counter, we'll, you know, build connections with people and whatnot. And I talk to a lot of veterans. I ask them a very similar question, and it's always Air Force. It's always Air Force, you know, and it doesn't matter if they were Marine, Army, Air Force. So, really good advice there. I don't know what it is about the branding, about the image that they've portrayed to him of being a Marine. And I've got a couple of cousins that are Marines, so he's got some exposure to that. At least just like something that calls to him about it. But he really wants to jump out of airplanes. And I think his identity is he's like the kid who's willing to do all the things other kids are scared of. Yeah. Like that's the identity that he's kind of created for himself.
Well, if you want to jump out of airplanes, you can go down to Zephyr Hills and have a heck of a good time. I mean, that's a lot more fun.
He definitely
wants to have fun out of everything.
He definitely wants to have a gun in his hand, you know, and use it when he hits the ground for something.
There you go.
Somewhat positive, you know. And then the other aspect is, you know, military service very honorable, but you wonder what the leadership of the United States is going to look like during the time that he serves. So, how did that impact you guys in your decision, or does it not impact the decision? I'm always very curious about that because you're essentially executing.
Yeah, I do have a good
executing somebody else's will.
So I joined 2 months after 9/11. I was in the military. I joined like everybody at that time. It was all American flags and patriotism and all the things that went with that. At the end of the day, I stayed because it's a badass job. And I like the guys I was working with. That was for me. Like there's not a lot of jumping out of airplanes, PAs, you know, like that, you don't get to do that a lot. You don't, there's not a lot of get a place where you get to be a PA and you're doing classes on shooting MP5s and like that doesn't exist a lot of places. So it really, that's what it came down to. When I left active duty and even with what I still do with 20th group, it is, I mean, there's a book of called The Men, the Mission in Me. And that's what it comes down to. The guy nailed it. Mm-hmm. Pete Blaber. And so that's what it is for me.
It doesn't matter necessarily what the mission is.
It doesn't, because I mean, yes, there's some
from a military perspective. I'm talking
at that point you're doing it because you have to kind of believe in the system. You can't stay there if you don't, to whatever degree, because the politics of it, yes, it does affect it. Absolutely. Like there's stuff that you're gonna do that you're like, this is stupid. This is whatever. But at the end of the day, if we weren't doing the things we were doing, regardless of how you think about the politics, you're going to have IEDs on I-95. It makes it a lot easier to go where the bad guys are and let them try 100%. To kill us there than to try to fight them out of here.
Yeah, 100%.
Perfect way to say it. Yeah. At the end of the day, I joined in 1985. I served through the Clinton years, the Obama years, the George Bush years. At the end of the day, it's about the person that's standing next to you. It's about you taking care of your buddies. And it doesn't really matter who's in charge. You're going to do the missions. They're going to be, like Chris said, they're going to be good or bad, but you're going to do them, and you're mainly going to do them to make sure that the people to your right and left come back home.
Come back home.
And that's at the end of the day, it's all about the person next to you. It's not about politics. It's not about whether there's WMD, whatever the questions are. It's about, well, doesn't matter. We're going anyway. Since we're going, I got to make sure I'm there to take care of the person next to me, because I know they're going to take care of me.
I have a substantial fear of World War III starting without me. Like that sounds ridiculous, but I'm like, I don't want it. I don't want to not go. You know, like I have a, you know, thinking about my kids doing it and all the other stuff. It's all of that stuff. And it is there. And then you get to the point where, I mean, my career is more or less over. I'm at the very last little tail end of it. Finished now my last maybe year, maybe two, whatever that is. And that's a hard thing. Like there, you talk about identity crisis. I mean, there's parts of me that are already having it. So,
Speaking of a World War III, if it got where the situation was bad enough, do you think they would call back some of the, I want to say old timers, but like how bad would it have to get in order to all hands on deck? We need everybody.
9/11.
Yeah,
9/11. They did it. Yeah. They pulled everybody back. Yeah. Unfortunately, until you're 65 years old, when you retire, they can still pull you back, and they could probably pull you back afterwards.
You can, medical officers are 70.
70.
You get pulled back till 70.
Anderson.
Yep.
Bud Anderson. Yep. They did it during the first Gulf War. They pulled a colonel out of retirement. And he was running a medical center in Gallup, New Mexico. And guess what? You're now going to be in charge of all the special operations medics in the world.
And if you need it, if they need it, they need it. You know, and then that's the other thing too, is that you take somebody like Mike, you can't replace that experience. Like you can't just find a guy and be like, go do this. That was hard earned 25 years of very hard earned experience that you can't teach that in a book. So.
And that's something that we need to follow up on. And there's other people that do it. My old unit is good for many reasons. The biggest one is they don't forget where they came from. Mm-hmm. And the standards are the standards. They do not change. The standards are the standards. If you don't meet them, you don't go. But they take care of their own, and they don't forget where they came from. They still bring back the veteran unit members or former unit members to say, hey, we're doing this now. Have you guys tried this? And when you did, how did it work? You know, what were the pitfalls? I mean, it'll cut out half of the experimentation they have to do just by asking, well, what happens when we're doing this and we have to all evacuate? What's the easiest way to do it? Well, do it this way. That's the way we tried it. Or there's other ways, but this works for us.
Yeah.
If you haven't done it, especially, I mean, the military for 20 years was at war. So they didn't train right. They didn't train correctly. Mm-hmm. I mean, the biggest thing they would do is force people to go to the National Training Center or the Joint Readiness Training Center before they went to combat, which, hey, it's something, but you're not trained the way you were before. I mean, the missions that you were trained to do, some of them, they don't even do anymore.
Yeah, it's
because they've lost the skill set.
Yeah, it's definitely a whole other show. We'll definitely have you back because you just got me down. We're about to go down another rabbit hole when you talk about that. So I very much want to thank you again. This is Mike Chesney. I am Chris Hasnauer. This is The Dose Adjustment.
Yeah, Amir Rahimi, thank you for listening. And yeah, thank you for being on. It was very interesting.
My pleasure. Absolute pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you, guys. See you on the next episode.
The information provided in this podcast is for educational and informational purposes only, and it does not establish a physician-patient or pharmacist-patient relationship. The opinions expressed by the hosts and guests are their own and do not constitute medical advice. This content is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any medical condition. Always consult with a licensed healthcare provider in your area before making any changes to your personal healthcare regimen or acting on any medical information shared in this podcast.